Support your curiosity by becoming a member of KCRW. That way you can help ensure KCRW music, news, and culture will continue to thrive and fulfill your need to know. Donate at kcrw.com/join.
Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Schneider of TV Guide Magazine, and this is The Spinoff. Joining me on the show, as always, is Joe Adalian of Vulture.com. Joe, live from Vegas. Hello, Joe.
Well, hello, Michael. Good to see you again on the radio.
Is that your NPR voice, by the way? You know, there's been a lot of talk about NPR voice on social media the past couple of weeks. So,
you know, I always try for the NPR voice.
we'll do it throughout this episode. And we are very excited to welcome to the KCRW studios, Betsy Beers.
Yay!
Hi, is this my NPR voice?
That is very nice.
Hi, you guys. You're listening to NPR.
I like it. Betsy's the executive producer of some shows you may have heard of, a little show called Grey's Anatomy, another one called Scandal, and How to Get Away with Murder. That's the way you say it, right?
That was really well done, actually.
Thank you.
Very accurate representation.
And also the forthcoming The Catch, coming mid-season to ABC. Along with her partner Shonda Rhimes, Betsy oversees one of the consistently best blocks and highest rated blocks of television, Thursday nights on ABC, TGIT, or TIGIT. Do they call it that?
TIGIT? That's a first, and I'm super excited about it.
Yeah,
I wish you could tweet that and have people know what you were saying.
Sounds vaguely dirty, but
don't forget the hashtag. It's always the hashtag.
That's right. Or hashtag, what is TIGIT?
Or Betsy, you actually described it in a speech at Marie Claire event earlier this year as two chicks, three time slots.
No way.
And a pizza place.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
So in this speech, we'll jump right in. You gave a great description of your job. So, you know, when people run into you on planes and you don't lie and tell them that you're a doctor or something else, how do you describe your job these days to folks?
I'd like to say that I am a very good fake doctor.
Yeah.
I am an excellent fake doctor.
You've had plenty of practice.
I have. If you would like a bad diagnosis, if you want it to be totally inaccurate but very emotionally fulfilling and, you know, very believable but not at all good, I'm perfect for that.
Yeah, because you know all the jargon at this
I know
point.
All the jargon. I know when to make a worried face. And I know when you put a bunch of symptoms together, vaguely what it's supposed to look like. But that's pretty much it. So
okay. My
actual job is it's kind of an interesting combination of lots of different stuff. But essentially, I am the non-writing executive producer. And I oversee and am competent to do, I think, anything but write, direct, or act. Pretty much. I also can't pay for things personally. So.
But it's everything else. And to quote you in this speech, you said you're qualified to develop, sell, cast, place music, help edit, costume, approve sets, pick writers, fire people, yell at studio and network executives, apologize to studio and network executives, and of course, buy lunch. And most importantly, you helped decide that Patrick Dempsey looked great unshaven.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
So,
thanks.
Again.
Thanks so much for that. That's,
yeah. But did we miss anything, by the way, in your job description? I mean, that sounds like 12 jobs anyway.
I think that's pretty accurate. I think that was – I'm impressed that I got all that into one tiny Marie Claire speech. But yes, I think that's a pretty accurate description. It's pretty much anything that anybody needs to make the show better.
Mm-hmm.
I have to be competent and willing and able to do. Competent, I'm not sure about. Willing and able to do, absolutely.
You also said in the description that one of the key part of your jobs is keeping secrets.
Oh, yes.
You know, which makes you a bad source for journalists, but a good partner and a good producer. What sort of secrets does one have to keep? You know all about cast changes sometimes before cast members themselves mm-hmm. know about
mm-hmm.
it, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
But talk about the CIA part of your job of keeping secrets.
I can't talk about very much of it because it's a secret.
Mm-hmm.
But it's pretty much you tend to know things before anybody else does. Things happen that if you do your job, nobody ever hears about, which is part of the job too. And, you know, there are a few people who always know something, but usually just a few. And that ranges everything from issues that occur to plot points. I mean, we've had situations where Sean has come up with a plot point and wanted to keep it incredibly top secret and literally, it had a code name, And only a few of us knew, and we would only refer to her as the code name for a while.
Yeah, what kind of code names do you use?
Oh, you just kind of pick a code name. Every once in a while, it depends on who picks it, but it's usually somebody else's name or something sort of random. But it's pretty much a range of anything that we feel like is important to keep as a secret. And I think the example that I gave in the Marie Claire speech had to do with taking care of an actor who was not in incredibly great condition at one point, and did you want to know who it was? And it's a secret.
You're kind of the CEO of this whole operation.
Exactly, exactly.
And that includes personnel. That includes making sure that money is being spent the proper way.
Yep.
I mean, it's a fascinating job, to be a non-writer producer. And we've seen a rise in non-writing producers. That's a big part of the business now, especially as we've seen more and more writers and actors become more active in producing and build these big companies like Shonda has.
Yeah, I think, making television nowadays is a very, very complicated job. And we're expected to make what is essentially a tiny movie every week. And there are a lot of different moving pieces, and you would have to be able to clone yourself to be in all those places at once. And I think it's crucial to have somebody else who is competent and capable and has been there since the beginning, usually, to help actually both push forth the creator's vision and the overall vision of the show and fulfill the expectations of the studio and the network and what we were trying to achieve. And that's what's really great about the job is, first of all, for me, what I love about it is no day is the same. Every single day is different because every day something new gets dropped on my desk. And it's a great kind of platform to be able to do as many different things as possible whenever people need them. And I do think it's a really, really important job. I think that there were periods of time where it maybe wasn't as necessary when shows were more straightforward many, 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 many years ago. But since it has become so multi-layered and complicated, it really helps to have a bunch of boots on the ground.
Can I ask you one follow-up question on that?
Please.
I want to ask you about, you're right, it is something that's become much more important recently, but there is some historical precedent in this. I think of Eduke Vincent, who I believe was mostly, although he may have done some writing, but he was a production partner for Aaron Spelling.
Yep.
I guess he did do some writing, but he was also known as sort of the CEO guy, or maybe it's the opposite. Maybe I'm actually wrong on that. But and then even Brian Burke with J.J. Abrams. I'm wondering, are there any people, we always ask writers, who were your role models? Who did you look after? Directors. I'm wondering if there's anyone in your job, can you look to, or maybe in the world of business or, some famous CEOs, is there anyone that you pattern yourself, or have you sort of been a self-creation without sort of any guidance?
Well, I come from movies. Both Shonda and I started in movie production, and she wrote and I produced. And I think actually my job is more based on what a movie producer does. Mm-hmm. And when we first started working together, since we'd never done television, we didn't know anything about the way television worked, we sort of organized it the same way a movie producer would work with a writer or a director. And really in movies, the director is kind of the visionary of a lot of what goes on. And in television, obviously, it's the writer. So we just transplanted that same relationship and applied it to TV when we were doing the pilot of Grey's, and it sort of continued that way. I didn't know what the role model was in TV because I had never done TV before. So we just figured that it made sense to have somebody who was there from the beginning, from development, as we like to say, like from pitch to like production all the way through to pickup. But somebody who's there from the very, very beginning who essentially can be part of all the decisions as they're getting made so that as you move forward and hopefully go into production and start to make a television show, you are privy to everything that's gone on at every stage, so you're competent and capable to go forward and continue to push the vision forward. So my models were really, the people that I worked with in movies. Like very early on, I worked with Galen Hurd, who's an amazing producer and is producing television
right,
too.
Right, Walking Dead.
Yeah, Walking Dead, and is just an incredibly smart woman and was an amazing person to get to watch. I ran a company for Mike Newell, who was great. I worked with Mark Gordon. I had a lot of experience with producers who took the job very seriously, and what I was really interested in doing was really being boots on the ground. So in terms of the world of television, I've later found out that there were people who were sort of doing it around the same time that we were. Because as you said, I think you pull up an Aaron Spelling instance, but for the most part, back in, I would say, earlier times, 80s and 90s, there were production companies.
right,
or studios that ended up providing that same sort of service. So MTM did it, or, you know, Carsey Werner did it, or,
right,
you know, there were several groups such as that. But in terms of this specific sort of relationship with a creator, I think now it's popping up more and more as people who are creating TV want to make more than one television show, or as a show becomes incredibly complicated and it's like a little movie. So that's where I think it's sort of grown to, and where it came from, I think, was, you know, definitely for me, the film.
Well, let's jump in the Wayback Machine.
Yeah.
Way before you were deciding whether or not Patrick Dempsey should have a 5 o'clock shadow.
Scruff.
A little scruff. And even before you worked in movies, you tried your hand first in acting.
Yeah. America, you got saved a whole shit ton of pain.
Yeah.
On that front. Yeah. My father was a theatrical agent, and he actually represented actors in the 40s and 50s and was involved in live television.
Mm.
So
wow.
When I grew up in the 60s, he was around, and I was always around the whole idea of actors, and I learned how to read by, like, sitting on his lap and reading, like, TV Guide.
Yep.
There you go.
Boom, boom.
And boom. Got it in there, you guys.
Got it in there. Thank
Can
you.
Can I have my $50?
Yes. Here you go.
Okay, awesome. But reading TV Guide, and he would sit with me on his lap, and he'd point to his clients on television, and I'd have to be able to identify them. And so pretty early on, I decided that acting was clearly what I wanted to do, and I actually trained as a kid a little bit. And I acted all the way through elementary school, high school, and college. And then I was sure I went to New York, and I was sure that, you know, I was going to be the next Lady Macbeth. It was going to be the most amazing. It was going to be incredible. And very quickly, I realized that nobody wanted to hire me to play Lady Macbeth. But I found that people I had more of a likelihood that I would be hired in comedy roles. And I kept getting hired as sort of either really old people, which is odd because I was in my 20s. And I guess that just tells you something about what I was looking like at the time. Either that or I was worried a lot. I have no clue. I guess old before my time. But I found this improv group downtown and joined that and found that I loved that world. And then somebody in the group and I split off and created our own group. And so I did sketch comedy, improv, wrote music, produced, although I didn't know what that was called. And I acted in commercials and waitress to support the group as well. So that was sort of my first foot in the producing door, and also it was when I really realized that I really loved comedy.
Is there any video evidence of this?
Yeah, exactly. Any commercials on YouTube that we could find?
Or? Oh, my God. I think I've had them all destroyed. I think there have been people who – B613 went out, and I hired them to get them all.
The vault.
The vault. They're all in the vault with Papa Pope. I don't know if there are, but I played an angel in a – Minute Maid orange soda commercial, and that was really impressive. I don't think I had any lines, but I looked frightened. I was really good at looking frightened. I played frightened bank managers. I played played frightened. A lot of fright, apparently. I looked worried, which goes to the age thing.
I guess so.
Apparently. So. I'm hoping to sort of Benjamin Button myself and kind of go backwards in time here. But yeah, I did that for several years and then moved out to California in the hopes of being a wacky next-door neighbor in a sitcom. And that also didn't go so good, as it turned out.
No. And did you make it onto any pilots?
No, I got nothing. I got here and I started to audition, and it was the late 80s, and I thought all my agents in New York told me I could be a wacky next-door neighbor.
Yeah,
a sitcom.
And really, that was the height of the wacky next-door neighbor.
Oh, my
that
God.
Was the age of
was,
the wacky next-door neighbor.
It was like, it was absolutely, it was like there should be shows just called Wacky Next-Door Neighbor.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't be the lead. They'd still just be the wacky next-door neighbor. But I found that most people wanted Suzanne Summers. Like, they wanted Suzanne Summers with big blonde hair and, you know, comely and fabulous and lots of giggling. And I was not comely nor fabulous. And people kept suggesting, maybe you need a nose job. That would work. Or some other things could be augmented potentially.
Oh, Hollywood.
Oh, Hollywood, yes.
I love it. And so I couldn't get a job waitressing, which I am very good at, by the way, just for the record, if anybody needs to know that.
So if this whole Shondaland thing
so
falls apart,
that I really
you've got a backup.
I can keep a lot of ketchup orders in my head.
Yeah.
But I couldn't get a waitressing job, so I found out about this thing called reading. And I learned how to read scripts and do story notes. And over the course of like 2 or 3 months, that sort of transmogrified into a job where I got a job at a studio reading. And then I recommended a movie, which was called I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka. And they said, oh, we'll let you work on the movie. And I thought, this development thing is the easiest job I've ever seen in my life. So I actually had a dark night of the soul, and I thought about it, and I realized that this was coming very naturally to me, and acting clearly didn't. Mm-hmm. So I shut the door on that, and I got to say, I never looked back. And I started my development career, you know, working in the movie business, and then moved up from being a reader to a development person, and then moved up to producing.
So there was never a sort of a desire to maybe cast yourself in a small role on one of your shows?
You know, it's come up in the past, and the one thing I definitely feel is I have been a struggling actor, and I think the idea of taking a part away from an actual decent actor is kind of a crime of humanity. And if there's somebody out there who could get the part, I think that that's probably better and wiser. I will say that I have occasionally – my voice has appeared occasionally on shows just because,
really?
You know, you need someone to play a 911 operator and time is running out, or I did a voice for – Private Practice at one point. Every once in a while something will come up and I'll do that. But for the most part, I think staying off screen is probably a gift to humanity.
But that's how you got your SAG card, right?
I do think, though, if Shonda can have a year of a yes and go on the Mindy Project, I think that, you know, at least play a corpse on something. You know, everyone should play a corpse once in their career, I think.
I think that's actually really true. And I do feel like maybe at the end of the run of Grey's Anatomy, you know, I can – at least sit in the back of a funeral or something. I'm not really sure if that or play a corpse. But I think maybe at some point before the end, just to kind of sit there and be part of it.
Well, you got to break the fourth wall. Both you and Shonda are there, and then the camera pans back.
You know, speaking of Shonda, how did you actually meet Shonda? She just mentioned movies, I guess. So how did that come together?
I was working at the time for a producer named Mark Gordon, and she was a very successful, excellent screenwriter. And we had just, Mark Gordon and I, working with him, had just gotten into the idea of doing television. And the truth for me was I was always a secret television freak. I loved TV. I watched it constantly. I never told anybody because in the movie business, that was like, you do what? You watch television?
And this was understood.
Which, no, I mean, neither. It's like, why did I have to make a choice? It's like LA and New York. Why do you have to? Well, you have to choose. Like, what is this?
Snobs.
Like, exactly. So I never really thought I had to make a choice, but in those days, and honestly, you guys, I know I'm totally going off topic, but the Golden Globes, they still put TV in the back of the room.
Right.
I mean, it's like you're eating your hair in the back of the room, and like Jack Nicholson was always sitting in the front. I always thought, well, you can mix it up, you guys. No one's going to get a disease by sitting next to somebody on television.
Yeah.
It's like ridiculous. You know, but back in the days in 1857 when I met Shonda, no, that was probably, I think, 2002, 2003, she was looking to develop a television show. We just recently sort of officially entered the television arena. And a woman who I knew who I used to work with at the company had gone off to work at ABC, whose name is Suzanne Patmore Gibbs now. Mm-hmm. And she used to be Suzanne Patmore. And she called and said, you know, there's this writer I love who I think you would really hit it off with her, and she wants to develop a television show. And that was Shonda. So Shonda, who was meeting producers all over town and trying to figure out who she wanted to develop with, came in and sat down. And we kind of hit it off immediately. We shared a lot of the same sort of literary influences, and she has a really good sense of humor, and she was really sharp, and I loved her taste. Like, we just started talking about lots of different things we liked and the TV shows that she was watching, because she was rapidly watching television kind of just ravenously. And it was one of those things where you meet somebody and you think, wow, I just really like hanging out with her. I really thought that she was just delightful to be with, and she had so many ideas, and she was just I felt immediately comfortable.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I seem to remember the first project that you guys developed for ABC was the War Correspondents project. Talk about the learning process in developing that. Obviously, it didn't move forward, and I assume you learned a lot in that sort of – you played into developing
Grey's. Oh, my God. We learned a ton. She wrote an amazing script. It was loosely based on source material about female war correspondents, and we talked about characters and ideas and story, and then – she kind of went off and created this amazing world of these women who traveled to this foreign country, and essentially it was sort of like being embedded. And these women, all of whom knew each other because they were always being put in the same spot all over the world. And this event that broke out while it was going on, and the characters' backstories sort of started to come out. And the thing that I remember best was the script was incredible. She did an incredible job. And as is the case with Shonda, she just sort of goes off and writes this thing and comes back and you think, okay, I don't have to do anything. This is genius.
Right.
I'm just going to sit here and eat my lunch. This is great.
Just hit print and hit send.
Exactly. Boom. Exactly. And the theme music starts and it's good. But she did. She wrote this really beautiful piece of writing. And I think we got actually pretty close to getting picked up. But the war had actually just recently broken out.
Yeah.
This was after, obviously, 9/11. And so they decided not to pick it up because they didn't think the time was right. Now, the other thing I have to tell you, though, about it was I think we'd both come from movies, so we had no idea what a TV budget was.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a whole section, I remember, with tanks coming into a large city and a scene in like a sports arena with thousands of people. And I remember now we went back and read it a while ago, and I thought, this is a $25 million pilot that we wrote, like that one you wrote. I mean, it's...
Right, you had suggested George Clooney as one of the leads.
It was going to be great. Exactly. It was like unbelievable. But yeah, it was a really, really great experience. And we both realized we really, really liked working together, that we'd had a really good time. So she came back the next year and we tried to think of something else that would be a great television show to do. And she was really interested in the world of medicine. And she had thought, I think, in the past about it. This is well documented, but she thought about being a surgeon and she was very, very interested in surgery. And my thing about medical shows was I never kind of understood them. I mean, they're always running around and they're poking people with things and they're yelling and mm-hmm. there's lots of stats and people, you know, punching people with equipment. And I said that always made me feel stupid because I watch TV and I understand it sort of, but I don't. And she said, well, it's great because there are these things called interns and they don't know what they're doing either. And I said, great, a television show for me. I don't know what I'm doing either. So she said, well, we could tell it from the point of view of interns. And we talked, you know, did the same sort of development process of sort of, you know, talking about different ideas. And then she did that thing where she just went off and she percolated it in her big brain and handed this pitch that was actually pretty close to what Grey's Anatomy ended up being.
And that was 12 years ago.
That was 12 years ago.
Can you believe it's been that long?
I know. And sometimes I can, and then other times I really can't. I was talking to somebody recently about, they were saying, oh, favorite moments from the past 12 years. And to me, in a weird way, the first couple of years are really, like they're years and moments that are super, super immediate. And then there are other periods that just aren't. But honestly, if I really thought about it, no, I don't think it's been 12 years. I would have said maybe 6. I'm sitting here amazed and horrified at the like, oh, my God, it's been 12 years. I mean, it's great it's been 12 years, but it's also you don't really process that time.
Well, I remember at the time, too, when that was on the air at ABC, there was a whole, of course, two or three different regimes ago at ABC. Successful producers like yourself are still there. Then people who run the network mostly aren't. What do you remember, though, about, you know, that was a big project for ABC during a big year for ABC, right? That was also the year that Desperate Housewives and Lost both launched. And you launched third. You sort of were saved. And famously at the time, people didn't quite know, well, why are they holding it? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? There was – I don't think you reshot the pilot, but maybe you made some changes. Tell us what you remember about that process. I'm curious your thoughts.
I think the initial experience was, as I said, like we'd never done this before, so I didn't know what to expect. I mean, we kind of didn't know what to expect. We didn't know what was normal. We were picked up last. We were put in mid-season. And for us, in a weird way, it was the biggest gift you could ever give anybody because what it meant was we had a little more time to retool, you know, to work on the show. And we also had this amazing thing happen, which actually happened, I think, with Scandal as well, although, you know, because I'm gumming my food at this point since so many years have gone by. But you get to actually put all of the episodes in the can and then you air. So we had this kind of amazing experience of doing the whole first 12-plus pilot, which got reduced in the airing dates to the first 8. And then we stopped after the 8th episode, as I remember. But it was kind of great because there was another factor, which was because Desperate and Lost were already on the air and everybody was paying so much attention to them, we kind of sort of slunk off in a corner for the most part and just – made the show, and ABC was great about that. They gave notes, but they were pretty much like, okay, this seems to be going along okay. We did some minor adjustments to the pilot. We ended up, you know, adding a character, and then episode 101, there were more issues with. So Shonda ended up going back and retooling portions of episode 101. But 102, sorry, 101 is – well, all the numbers have changed, you guys. It used to be 100 and 101, but let's just say the second episode, which is always – and you guys can speak to this too because you've been doing TV for obviously 3 or 4 years now, right?
Century, yeah.
It's been – exactly. Do you think so? It's like – here's my my teeth in my cup. But I think what's – it's just – it's kind of amazing that you have this opportunity to – get to kind of screw with stuff and make it better, and then when they leave you alone and you get to air it, it's kind of incredible. So we didn't have any idea what was going to happen. We didn't know if we were good or bad, to tell you the truth. Like, we loved it. I mean, I'm not going to speak for Shonda. She's not here, and I know she loved it, but I loved it. And because we had no expectations, I think we just wanted people to really like it. And there was this kind of horrifying moment when we first aired where part of my job was to know what the ratings meant. And I had no clue what the ratings meant because I forgot to ask somebody. And I think everybody had kind of not gigantic expectations, but the first episode that aired, which I think was like Easter Sunday, 2005.
Yeah.
Or it was the week after Easter, but we literally just wrapped the show. And we aired the episode, and the next morning the numbers came out, and it was my job. Like, I was going to call people and tell them how the numbers were. And I realized I looked at the numbers, and I didn't really understand this. I called a friend of mine who'd done TV like 10 years before, and I said, these are the numbers. And he said, oh, yeah, those aren't very good.
Those are not good for 1995.
For 1995 numbers. Yeah. So I called poor Shonda, and I said, the numbers aren't really very good. She said, oh, that's really too bad. And meanwhile, my cell phone's ringing, and she goes like, "This is really weird. My cell phone keeps ringing." And it turned out the numbers actually were pretty good.
You know, the other interesting thing about launching the show back in 2005, that was before social media.
Right?
That was before Twitter, before Facebook. I mean, think about it now. That's sort of a big part of kind of your job. I mean, you know, Shonda's on Twitter. You're on Twitter, right?
I'm barely on Twitter.
But
uh-huh.
You're there.
I'm technically on Twitter.
You do a podcast.
I do a podcast. That's my weird way of trying to supplement my inability to tweet in interesting fashion. Like, Shonda's a genius tweeter. Mm-hmm. Her casts are masterful. And every once in a while, I just go, yay, on Twitter. But yeah, I do a podcast because that means that I'm contributing something to the social media
but
feed.
How's that changed the game? I mean, over the years, as the audience has been able to be more vocal leading up to a certain cast member's departure this past year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was easygoing.
Oh, yeah, that was quiet, right?
Nobody got sweated up about that one at all.
Yeah.
I think, and it's weird, I would ask you guys the same question, too. I think it's changed everything because, first of all, in terms of how quickly information spreads, it's crazy. Second of all, I think that there's an immediacy now to reaction, which barely gives anybody a chance to process until you're on to the next. But you also have direct access to your fans. And one of the things I think is incredibly cool is that you can live tweet. And so you can actually be close to people you don't know everywhere while you're watching a show together, which I think is one of the most amazing parts of social media. And the fact that your fans can have such sort of direct contact with what the show is and how the show works. I mean, when we started, people wrote fan letters. Fan letters, yeah. You guys, with paper and stamps. You guys remember stamps?
The stamps. And quilt pens.
And quilt pens.
Exactly. Bread was 5 cents. We all wrote it to work on a horse. But I must admit, I'm a little bit – they joke at the office that I'm a little bit of a Luddite about this stuff because I do too much information coming at me too fast. I don't process it. Like, I'm just somebody who kind of needs to focus on one thing at a time, which I know sounds counterintuitive given my job. But one of the things I do is try to focus on one thing at a time.
Yeah. Well, I think that's – you know, one of the problems with Twitter is that you really can get sucked into it and suddenly it is a time suck. It does take a big chunk of your day and it is a little more difficult to juggle everything else and then also keep one eye on Twitter. And you've got 25 jobs, so I would understand if you can't be on top of it at all times. I want to ask something about the LA Times called you the Shondaland Whisperer. So talk now about sort of how you and Shonda divide and conquer. What's your relationship like? What's sort of the day like? How do you sort of interact throughout the day, the week?
Our days always vary. I mean, it's honestly where the improv training has come in incredibly well, which is it's been crucial for me knowing that in essence, I get up in the morning, I have a schedule, I show up, and inevitably the schedule changes. So in terms of the way that I sort of operate, I think the whisper that it's a very nice thing to say. Nobody's a horse there, so that's just really. But it's that I think I have to be – I have to figure out the most effective way to get something done in the quickest amount of time when appropriate and also when you need to stop and think about things. Because I think very often when you're in production and you're in development at the same time, there are not only lots of balls you're juggling in the air, but there are lots of people expecting reactions to things. So one of the things that I try to pride myself on is analyzing a situation either very quickly or very slowly to figure out when to move next. And part of that is honestly at what point is it important for Shonda, who's doing a series of very often different tasks. Sometimes they're duplicative, sometimes they're different. I mean, sometimes we're both working on development and sometimes we're both dealing with a production problem, or sometimes we're both dealing with a challenge in scheduling or trying to navigate a network or studio landscape. But then other times she will be working on editing, working in the writer's room, focusing on script, and I'll be doing a lot of what I do, which is sort of supervising the day-to-day and supervising the development and keeping an eye on sort of the traffic that's moving. So it's literally having to be sensitive to everything that's going on within the world and figuring out who the best person is to access for help when you need it as well. So it's a vague answer, but honestly, it's just trying not to stick your foot in it.
Yeah.
I think is the best description of being the Shonda Land Whisperer.
Do the two of you ever argue?
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I think like any good partnership, occasionally we don't agree, but we usually work it out. And we don't know. We're not big screamer yellers. It's primarily a pretty harmonious relationship, I got to say, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You can ask her.
Okay.
I think what's really great about having a very long time producing partner, person that you've worked with creatively is that there's both a shorthand, but there is the relationship is built on like listening and trust. So as sappy as that sounds, it's not about do we ever get in fights as much as it's about we've developed a process over the years of coming to decisions very often together and, you know, I mean, necessarily together.
In terms of current programs, right, it seems now we've talked about, oh my God, 12 seasons for Grey's Anatomy, but it seems completely conceivable, especially when you look at the ratings for this season and the creative balance the show seems to have gotten. I mean, the ratings right now are really, really good for a show in its 12th season. It's holding its own with How to Get Away with Murder and up there with Scandal now, even at the 8 o'clock time slot that it moved to last year. To me, it seems conceivable that Grey's Anatomy is the type of show that can reinvent itself and be around for another 8 years, 20 years, Law and Order style. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I could absolutely see that happening. With Scandal, though, I'm wondering in the back of your minds, if you sort of are starting to get to a point where you maybe see an expiration date, what's your thought on where the current projects in the Shondaland Empire go from here?
Well, I think all the Shondaland products in the Shondaland Empire are determined by one thing, which is, does Shonda still have stories that she wants to tell, or does Pete Nowak still have stories that he wants to tell, or do any of the wonderful people with whom we're developing in longevity and success, please, still have stories that they want to tell? And the Scandal question, I can't really answer because I don't know the answer, and that would be simply in Shonda's head. And how Shonda's feeling about the show and whether or not she feels like how many more seasons are there. So that's kind of not one that I can give you a really any great insight on. I can say on Grey's that I think I really hope that show goes till 2085.
Till the end of time.
Yes, exactly.
Till the apocalypse.
Until the Golden Globes put us in the front. Yes, exactly. And same with Pete. I have absolutely no idea what or where his head is in terms of murder. And that's something that is in the brains of the creators.
And you're referring to the show, not his where his head is in terms of what he thinks about actual murder.
Yes. Yes, although, yeah.
Who knows?
Who knows? Exactly. I was going to say, I think he did create a show called How to Get Away with Murder. So,
Betsy, I want to ask you something else. Because obviously the Shyamalan shows, they've been truly breakthrough in terms of colorblind casting and helping advance diversity in prime time. But I also know that's a topic that you guys don't love talking about. I think people bring it up because they want to sort of pay respect and compliment and
yeah.
say, like,
yeah.
Shyamalan, you guys really did open the door. And how amazing is it that two hit dramas on television are led by African-American women? That's amazing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I know you guys don't love talking about that. And Shonda kind of bristles sometimes when it comes up at, say, TCA.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, you know, it's all about the story. It's all about, you know, it's mm-hmm. story and character first. And so you guys don't really want to constantly have to discuss this and like have that on your shoulders. At the same time, it's a cool deal. So how do you sort of reconcile that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we've addressed this in different ways in the past, and I think there were a couple of years ago we got the DGA, the award from the DGA, and essentially, you know, the take from us was this is pissing us off because we don't see why there should still be an award for diversity and why there should need to be an award for diversity. I think the main thing about it is, look, we cannot imagine a world in which it is not diverse. I mean, that's the world we live in. When we first started talking about Grey's Anatomy, our biggest conversation was always about she wanted to create a world in which it looked like us and it felt like us. We were two women who didn't necessarily see ourselves on TV. We didn't see the kinds of relationship we had with our coworkers, with our friends. And that's just speaking as women on TV, with relationships with men and with other women and other people. And just it wasn't fully and accurately, we felt, looking like what we knew. So the whole kind of stock and trade for us has been just continue to live in environments that actually are accurate in portraying what our lives are like. So I think that's been just the determinant factor. I think the problem right now is that diversity is sort of being treated like a fad
mm-hmm.
or a trend, as though it's like a hair color. Or, wow, Priuses are really in. And it's not. It's the way people are. It's what we all are living in, and it's not a fad. It's been around forever. It's just people now have just decided to start talking about it. So I think it's mainly for me that I think it's something that we don't drive into the conversation as much because it's something that we feel like is part of our world, and in a weird way, the people who should be talking about it are the people who aren't portraying worlds like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where it starts. And it's not that they should be talking about it, it's just that maybe ask them, like, what's the difference? But it's definitely, look, it's the way we see the world, and I think it's a great world we're living in.
You mentioned that some people are treating it like a fad. Do you think that's the networks or studios? Some of them are being a little cynical in terms of how they treat diversity?
No, I don't think it's that as much as I think it's the way it's being publicized more, honestly, because I got to say ABC is the most amazing place to work on this. I mean, they're great. I love these guys anyway, but they've never thought about it. It's never even been a question or an issue from the moment we started working there 13 years ago. It was assumed and welcomed and accepted and desired that the world was accurately portrayed diversity-wise. So I've never gotten a sense, and I've only worked, honestly, at ABC because I've only chose ABC, so I can only speak to that. But it's always been an incredibly supportive environment for that. I think it's more the fact that it's being noted in such a way.
Hey, lighter question I have for you. Could you tell us, since you have said how much of a TV fan you are,
yeah.
Are there three shows lately that you are completely into that you have nothing to do with? Are there shows that you're completely obsessed over that aren't part of your empire?
Wouldn't it be screwy if I was like, oh, no. No, all I watch is Us. Yeah, I've watched – this is hard, actually, because I just started watching a lot of stuff again.
Right now.
I'm really, really, really looking forward to the next – season of Silicon Valley because I became crazy balls obsessed with Silicon Valley when I was watching it. Just kind of like nutty Silicon Valley person. I'm also watching this – I'm watching the show, and this has got nothing to do with any – which is called I'll Have What Phil's Having.
Oh, yeah.
Which is
yes.
the Phil
love
Rosenthal,
it. Yeah,
you know, like travelogue, because I also watch Anthony Bourdain, who I, you know, love Anthony Bourdain too. But my husband and I tend to watch a lot of food and travel and home improvement shows because I like watching people do something that I don't do for a living.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really relaxing. It's sort of like Teletubbies. You go home and – you turn on the television and I watch people like build things or sell things or make costumes or – and I think there's something about I'll Have What Phil's Having that I'm really, really liking just because it's Phil Rosenthal and he's tasting this stuff. So
yeah.
it's just super, super entertaining to watch. And I also – I really – I'm behind on this, but I really like You're the Worst. I binge-watched
yes.
the first season
Never.
Of it. And there's something about two naked drunk people in a driveway – that makes me feel so much more secure about my own life in a really great way. But that show I find to be absolutely, totally delightful too. I've been watching a bunch of other stuff. I mean, I'm just trying to sample stuff.
Well, it's good to hear that you've got great taste in television. I mean, this is your job after all. So it's good to hear that. I want to ask you two more things. First off, so Pete Norwalk in that LA Times article that I mentioned earlier, he said that you may have inspired How to Get Away with Murder's lead character, Annalise Keating.
I know, that's so funny.
So how so, do you think?
That's super apeshit. How so? You know what? I think he did actually qualify it, which uh-huh. we've had a conversation since too. But in that, I think he thinks I'm protective of the people around me, which I think is actually pretty true. I try to protect the vision of the creators of the shows, but I also try to make sure that people are treated okay. And I am very protective of the people that I work with. I like to think it's that. I don't really have her fashion sense. I've never covered up a crime before. I am married to a criminal defense attorney, so I actually am really good at helping pick juries and like weird ancillary stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I love the history of like criminal court law and all that stuff. So I think there's a certain amount of I just dig into all the stories with about the same amount of fervor and zest that Annalise does. And I think my home life is slightly more stable than hers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping. And maybe I'm a little better at controlling my mood swings. I'm hoping that's the case too, because she's having a rough go of it this season. Like, I'm super hoping it's Annalise last season,
yeah.
and even not this season, because it's just she's. It like, seems like she's got more on her plate.
Yeah, the commanding Annalise.
And I also like to feel like it's because I'm pretty good at juggling.
Yeah.
So I like to think maybe it's the juggling part and not the hiding the murdering part.
And the other question is, now that you're developing some comedies, is there a role for you as the wacky next-door neighbor?
From your lips to God's ears, boy. That will never happen in anybody's
I've
dreams.
I've got an idea.
Oh, good. I can
idea,
hardly
actually.
Wait. I can hardly wait.
Remember the Bob Newhart show? There was
totally.
A doorman.
Yes.
Who was just actually in the he was heard on the intercom. Right? Am I thinking that right, Mike? Anyone remember?
Lorenzo Music was the,
yes.
the guy who was the voice
yes,
of
exactly.
the doorman. Yeah.
I think there needs to be a show for, I don't know if people they're still doorman. You should just be on an intercom somehow. You should just be the intercom voice.
I am so up for that. Like, that would be manageable for my time. And
but now
you're
in
NPR makeup.
Voice.
Not my NPR voice?
Well,
no, you need a different voice, I think. I think there needs to be the TCA party voice.
The TCA party voice, where there's lots of screaming and swearing and, yes,
exactly.
and complaining about everything. Yeah, perfect.
This will be
okay.
a streaming show.
I think we're set. I think that's where we'll wrap things up there.
Screaming
so
and
fun.
Swearing yeah. and complaining about things, the shorthand to my life.
That's the name of your book coming out.
It's not the year of yes. It's screaming and swearing and complaining about things. That's good.
Coming in 2016. Well, thank you so much, Betsy.
Thank you so much for having me, you guys. This was so much fun.
Yeah, great having you on. Yeah. We appreciate it. And thank you, Joe, as always.
Thank you. It was so much fun to talk to you, Betsy.
Yay, Joe.
That's Joe Adalia, the West Coast editor of Vulture.com, and Betsy Beers, executive producer at Shondaland. If you want to follow Joe on Twitter, you can find him at TV Mojo, and Betsy is at Beers Betsy. So, because I guess Betsy Beers was taken?
It was taken. It was taken. Sad yeah. moment in my life.
Okay, but... we got to hunt that person down. And I'm Michael Schneider of TV Guide Magazine and TVInsider.com, and my Twitter handle is at Franklin Avenue. And that's it for this edition of The Spinoff. This podcast is produced by Caitlin Parker. Ray Guarna is our technical director with help today from JC Swadek. You can find past episodes of The Spinoff on iTunes, Stitcher, and pretty much everywhere where you can download podcasts. You can also hear it online at kcrw.com and on demand with the KCRW smartphone app. Until next time, this is The Spinoff, signing off.